Okay, we're glad to have you live and direct from where this evening?
Beautiful Miami Beach.
Okay, you're sitting there just looking out over the ocean, and this should get you... It should get you inspired for a lecture on the afterlife. And so we're ready to...
Well, the ocean always carries the concept of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings to mind the afterlife. So
all right. Well, okay. You can start your lecture.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wanted to mention an interesting observation, and that is that at the beginning of these classes, we mentioned the fact that the story of Rabbi Antigonus, who was criticized by these scholars for revealing a secret about the afterlife, and because of that, because he spoke too much, as the rabbi said, he wasn't careful in his words, so people walked out from his lecture and they said that there is no such thing as an afterlife. And it's very interesting, but that experiment that happened over 2,000 years ago was really repeated here with us. And you can check this back on the tapes. Because last week the question arose after we had discussed this, I believe it was four lectures. So someone raised that very same question. And I'm glad they did, by the way. It was very important that they raised that question, extremely important. But it shows exactly, precisely, that what happened then recurs, and that the Talmudic scholars were correct when they warned against the difficulty of expounding upon this topic in public. That's why, actually, it would only really be permissible to do it where people can question and can make sure that they have the proper idea. But the reason, of course, is that everyone has the idea of compensation. The compensation theory of an afterlife permeates every religion. And people are tied to that concept that if you obey God and you do these painful things that he tells you to do, then he is going to reward you. A reward is always considered something other, something to compensate you for your efforts. And most people live their lives with that shallow idea, that shallow notion. And the moment you take that notion away, it's very difficult to see the true idea. And many times I'll walk away and say, oh, there is no afterlife. And that's just a natural result of this kind of a discourse. So this is exactly what happened here. And I'm glad the question was raised because it's extremely important to, of course, to answer that question. But our concept of an afterlife, as we've mentioned, is not a compensatory concept. There's no compensation. It means that good which a person does in this life, which essentially is the recognition of the knowledge of Torah, and that is the ultimate reality behind all realities, and the value that one places on that knowledge. That is what gives a person a good life here, and it is augmented in the afterlife, but there is no compensation. That is the good, and the good will naturally be good for a person in this life because that is the good for man, and it will be even better in the afterlife because in the afterlife we aren't limited by the modes of perception that we are limited with in this existence. Okay, now I wanted to return to a point that I mentioned in the last lecture, and that is that the Torah really openly mentions, it's not a rabbinical statement, the Torah openly mentions the importance of constant study. And we cited Deuteronomy, and we mentioned that the Torah says that I believe it's Deuteronomy 4, let me see that. I'm sorry, it's Deuteronomy 6, the Shema, 6 from 6:6 and 6:7. That the Torah says that these words should be upon your heart, and you shall study them, teach them to your children, speak about them at home when you go to bed, and when you're walking, in every area of your life, basically. Which openly states that this is the good. But it's not just stated And this portion of the Torah, it is also stated in the prophets as well. It's stated, for instance, in the beginning of Joshua. In the beginning of Joshua 1, and it's Joshua 1, 6 and 7. 7 and 8. 7 and 8. Where, God told Joshua, he said that you should strengthen yourself very much to keep and to do all of the Torah which my servant Moses has commanded you. Do not turn to the right or to the left, in order that you should be wise in everything that you do, which shows, again, that the Torah produces, the proper study of Torah must result in a personality that is wise in every aspect of his or her life. And in the next verse it states, this Sefer Torah shall not cease from your mouth. And you shall, now the next word is vagisa. This word means an activity of the mind and of the mouth, a verbal, which means that a person should be constantly involved in Torah, verbally, mentally, and it says day and night, in order that you shall keep and be able to do everything that's written in it, because then you will be successful in your ways, and then you will be wise. Again, the repetition of the fact that the Torah leads to a person that is wise in every aspect of their life, because it teaches a person not just to be wise in a specific study. And I mentioned last week that specific studies, and actually there are studies that were conducted in the 40s on that. If a person, for instance, studies mathematics, does it increase his intelligence in other subjects? And the conclusion was that there is no real transference value from one subject to another. If you study mathematics, you'll increase your intelligence in mathematics, your skill in mathematics, but there's no transference value. But the Torah is an exception. The Torah is the only study that has transference value, because it teaches a person to apply his mind in every aspect of his personal life, no matter how difficult, no matter how much he must go against his emotions. So that is that has transference value, and the person will learn to apply the wisdom of Torah in every area of their life. And that's mentioned in Joshua. And then again, in the beginning of Psalms, for instance, where it says, describes the righteous person, and it says that in his Torah, he studies day and night. And, of course, Psalm 119 throughout discusses it again, and throughout the Psalms and other places. So this concept is not a concept of the rabbis, it's a concept of the Torah. And the reason is because that is the good for man. In the Shema is enunciated the commandment of love of God, and then in the very next verse it states that this love of God involves a constant preoccupation with the knowledge of of God's Torah. So that is the ultimate good. Okay, and now The question, of course, is that what if a person is unable? Oh, yeah. By the way, there's another place where it's mentioned. I think it's important to notice, and that is in Exodus 24, where the people accepted the Torah and they said, "Whatever God said, we will do and we will hear." Now, that is the rabbis say that a bat kol, that means a heavenly voice, came out at that moment and said that you who made that statement know the secret that is revealed to the angels. And there's a verse in the Psalms which states about the angels also that they do and then they hear. Of course, what is meant by this is quite simple, because it's impossible for a person to say I will do and I will hear. It doesn't make any sense, because you cannot do something before you hear the instruction to do so. So it's not logical to say that I will do and I will hear. It must be the reverse. You must hear first what someone wants you to do, and then you're capable of doing it. So how can the reverse be true? First I will do, or as the chosen visitor said, first we will do, and then we will hear. The answer is very simple, that there are two kinds of hearing. There's a hearing which is merely to know what one was instructed to do, and then there's a hearing which means understanding. For instance, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, means to understand the idea. It doesn't mean to hear. So what the people of Israel stated at that moment was, we will do the commandments, but more than that, even after we do them, we are finished with them, but now we must involve ourselves in understanding them. And that was the secret of the angels, because the angels are involved in contemplation of the knowledge of God. So that's why God, the Bat Kol, the heavenly voice, came forth and stated that these people know the secret of the angels. So this concept is really interspersed throughout the Torah and the prophets. I would like to mention something with regard to the practicality of this concept, because somebody may ask, they might say, well, that's all fine and well, we can understand that, but what about a person who is not such a great intellect, who is not the doesn't have the most brilliant mind, cannot really understand all the subtleties and the distinctions of the Talmud and the complex laws that we have in the Torah and Leviticus and the many parts of the Torah that are difficult to comprehend, to understand. A person doesn't have that kind of an intellect. So what does that mean? Does that mean that individual cannot have a share in the afterlife, in the world to come? So the answer is stated by the scholars. The scholars said that there were two tribes. One was Yisachar, and the other was Zevulun. And Zevulun would work, and they would support Yisachar so that Yisachar could involve themselves in study. In other words, Zevulun realized that they weren't capable of studying Torah to that degree as Yisachar. And therefore, what they did was they expressed their love of Torah by supporting Yisachar and permitting them to study Torah. Now, this, of course, means that does not mean, by the way, that Zevulun was idle and didn't study Torah themselves. That's impossible. Everyone on their level must engage in the study of Torah. That goes without saying. But then there's a question of how much a person can study. Not everyone is capable of study to the same degree. Now, the reason why, how does that work, though, we might ask. I mean, how does that work? It's very nice, but we just said that the whole afterlife is the perception and the appreciation and the knowledge. But the answer is, as Maimonides states, that God judges an individual according to two variables. One is the person's knowledge, and the other is the person's deeds. And you see, the deeds reflect the value that the person places on the knowledge. In other words, a person may have a lot of knowledge, but a person may have knowledge for various reasons. A person may study in order to be able to secure a position for themselves, in order to gain public fame. I mean, knowledge is something which people respect. So a person may study for that reason. If a person studies for that reason, then the Torah really has no value, because the only time the Torah has value is when it's recognized in itself as the good, and it's the value that is placed on the Torah knowledge, not just the Torah knowledge per se. So therefore, we're dealing with two variables. Sometimes a person can have less knowledge, but more appreciation and a higher value attached to the Torah. So such a person will be could be on a higher plane than a person who has greater knowledge. And, however, you cannot do without the knowledge, for the simple reason that if there is no knowledge, then there's no recognition of what the good is. So the knowledge must give the person the recognition of what the good, but then the person must place their whole value system must be based on this knowledge. That must be the thing which they value most of all in life. So therefore, there are always two variables. And man is never perfect, So man is always subject to variation of degree in either variable. A person to study Torah just for the pure love of Torah is something which Abraham was able to do, great people that were able to do, but most people, even if they recognize the value, there is always an element there which is not really pure in terms of the motivation. This doesn't discount the Torah. I mean, God doesn't discount a commandment just because it's not 100% pure. That would be impossible for a person to reach that level. I mean, at once. It would be impossible. So therefore, even if a person during a lifetime never reaches that perfect state, that doesn't discount the value of the Torah. It simply reduces it to an extent, but it doesn't discount it. So therefore, there are always two variables. One variable is the deeds, and the second variable is the knowledge itself. You can have an individual which is greater in knowledge and less in terms of deeds, and then you have the converse, a person who is greater in deeds and less in knowledge. These two may in fact be equal, because the sum total is a certain result, and that result is the attitude of the soul towards the good, towards knowledge. This attitude is created by a recognition of what knowledge is, and the deeper one learns, the more the recognition of what that good is, and also the value that one places on it through one's deeds, so that these two variables work together. And that is why a person, for instance, the Talmud states that if a person has a son who is more intelligent than he is, so then he has to support that son in the study of Torah, and it is more important for the son to study Torah, because ultimately that son can be a greater scholar, but at the same time, this person cannot refrain from studying himself. You see, that's because you cannot have the deeds are wonderful, but the deeds don't mean anything if there is no personal recognition of what the good is. That recognition has to be firsthand. And the only way you know what Torah is through firsthand knowledge, means through the actual study of Torah. So that's why each individual has to work in according with the faculties and the abilities that God has given them. And of course, over here, I would like to say that the question, of course, will come to mind. Well, I mean, is that fair? I mean, why should the other fellow have greater ability than I have? And then you get to the area of envy and jealousy, which demands basically that we understand that concept too, because one of the Ten Commandments is that a person should not be envious, should not be jealous, and that means that it's a major law of the Torah. And the question, of course, is how can a person possibly prevent themselves from being jealous? By the way, jealousy does not mean that the simply a thought crosses an individual's mind that they feel jealous. That is not what the Torah means by jealousy. That a person is not responsible for at all. A person is never responsible for thoughts that go through their mind. That is not the Torah philosophy. It's only if the person follows it through with a deed, and if a person is envious of something that someone else has, and because of that envy it causes him to try to get the other person to sell it, then they're in violation. But it has to lead to an action, to a deed, a conscious action. Just emotions that play through an individual's mind never involves a Torah violation. It's just something that man is instinctual, and the instincts are always playing as themselves out in the human mind, and therefore the human mind can think of anything, and the Torah never restricts the human mind. It's an impossibility. But to consciously make an effort to follow a thought that is incorrect, that is where violation comes into the picture. Now, the question is, How can the Torah demand of us that we should not be envious if, in fact, to be envious not just as a thought goes through a person's mind, but really to be seriously involved in this way of thinking to the point where it affects the individual, the person is preoccupied with it. And he really, he's overcome by the desire. It bothers him. So the answer is that if a person is envious, it involves either one or two basic principles that the person is denying. The principle of Torah. One principle of Torah is that God is the creator, and God being the creator means that we recognize that his right to create is supreme, and we could never dictate to God how he should create. Therefore, if God creates intelligences that are superior to us, we have no right to complain because that's his will, and his will is supreme. And similarly, there are animals that don't have abilities that that we have, and we don't say that's unfair. We don't say we can't dictate fairness to God and say it's only fair for God to create everything equal. That's an absurdity. In democracy, we have a concept of equality, but that's just we're all equal before the law. It doesn't mean we're all equal. The idea of demanding equality, which is a concept I think that this generation has a little twisted from a logical point of view, from a realistic point of view, this concept is a very current notion, but it is blatantly false because we are not equal. God did not see fit to create beings that are equal. There are beings with greater intelligence, human beings with greater intelligence, lesser intelligence. There are animals with more strength than man, most of them, and there are various abilities that different creatures have. I mean, this is all part of God's creation. So once a person recognizes that idea, that concept, that God's will is supreme, so then they recognize that what the other person has is not my reality. In other words, God didn't give me that reality. So it's just a figment of my, and a person feels bad when they're envious. They feel, I could have had that. I should have had that. The imagination tells the person that they could have had that. But if that other person did not exist, they would never think about it. They'd be satisfied. The Torah demands that each individual look at their own life as if it is the only life, because in reality, this is the reality that God gave each individual. So each individual can only look at their own reality and say, this is my realm of reality that God gave to me. God gave something else to someone else. That's his will. If I am upset about this, then it's an indication that I am simply denying the creator's right to create. So that's a violation of the very concept of God as the creator. So that's why it's a major violation. The other possibility for a person to be envious is if a person says, look, I'm not envious that the other person has greater ability than I have. I'm envious of the fact that they accomplished so much and I really didn't do much with my life. So, in other words, they're not jealous of the intrinsic abilities, but they're jealous of the situation that the other person has, which they brought about and which this individual didn't bring about. So that is a violation of another principle, namely free will. Because if a person accepts the idea of the Torah, that if each individual has free will, so then if another person was able to act in a superior way, that was because of their free will. And if you fail to do so, then it's your responsibility. You chose not to do so, and therefore there is no one to blame for it. The only thing a person can do is simply recognize the fact that they did not exercise their free will properly. It's their own responsibility. So envy is either a denial of the concept of God as creator, or else it's a denial of the principle of free will. It has to be one or the other. And in either case, it's a major violation against the two perhaps most basic. I mean, certainly the creator, idea of the creator is the most basic concept of Star, and man's free will is the most basic concept in so far as a human being, human life is concerned. So that's why this violation of envy is in the Ten Commandments. Of course, a person also, there's another factor here, and that is a psychological factor. And that is the person that is not envious, the truly perfected person, is not envious, A, because he recognizes that God has a right to create whatever he sees fit, B, that man has free will, but there is also a psychological factor as well. Another reason why a perfected person will not be envious. And that is that if, when a person is envious, a person always thinks that another individual has something which is of intrinsic value. Envy doesn't usually attach itself to small things. It usually attaches itself to something which an individual perceives as major. That person has, they have that. That's what I wanted, you see. Somebody has a little something extra, say, oh, well, that's not that important. It's always things that we deem extremely important. Now, the Torah personality recognizes that a person's life, the good life that a person could have, is only possible for an individual who has the true value system. So everything else, wealth, prosperity, honor, physical conveniences, all these things in human life for the perfected person play a small role. They're not non-existent, of course, they're nice. But the essence of a person's enjoyment in life will always be Torah, the study of Torah, knowledge. So therefore, whatever another individual has, you see, doesn't really strike a chord in the perfected person because it's not essential. It's not essential to them. They realize that the essential thing in having a good life is knowledge of Torah. That's it. If you have that, you have a wonderful life. If you less conveniences more, it's not going to really make a difference. So the envy is never evoked because simply psychologically it isn't evoked because the person doesn't project onto what another individual has as being essential in terms of life. And therefore, the emotion of envy is not evoked. Now, someone may ask, they may say, well, what about perfection itself? Why shouldn't I be envious of another individual who has perfection? And this person is enjoying such a wonderful life because they have perfection and I don't have it. The answer is that from a logical standpoint, envy of perfection is impossible, you see, because envy of the good, the ultimate good, is impossible, because the good is always a recognition of what one has. And living in line with reality, that's what the happiness comes from, the fact that the person lives in line with reality with what they have. So you cannot be envious of another's good. That's an intrinsic contradiction. Therefore, it is possible to be envious of everything except the good. The good is something which is intrinsically impossible to be envious of. Therefore, the person who has the principles of Torah, namely that he recognizes God is the supreme creator, and he has no right to dictate what God should create. He recognizes that man has a free will, and he recognizes his own reality, and he pursues through his free will the good, which is Torah. Such a person will have a very happy existence and will never experience even the emotion of envy. Okay? And that's important in terms of the afterlife, too, because I often get the question. People say, well, the afterlife, if there is such an afterlife, thing is an afterlife, very fun, but what's going to happen if the fellow next to me has a bigger portion in the afterlife than I do? So just like it's impossible now, as we have shown, is an impossibility even in this life, where we aren't in the most perfected state of the soul. Certainly, it's impossible to experience that emotion of envy in the afterlife, where the soul is in its most perfect state. But Rabbi Bolden mentioned mentioned the other side of the picture. He said if someone is envious of another individual's perfection, you can be sure it's something else that they're really envious of. But they are making a mistake in their imagination, confusing with perfection with really something else is really bothering them underneath. It's not the perfection. Maybe it's something else that that individual, due to their perfection, has, which is a mundane kind of thing. Okay, so now what I would like to take up is something, another point. I think it's an important one about the concept of the afterlife, and that is a principle which has to do. It also is important because it shows a person that the soul does not function the same as the body does. And this principle is called, Maimonides mentions the principle, it's called the oneness of the perceiver and the perceived. Okay, now at first that sounds kind of strange, because if I perceive a tree, I am not one with the tree. What happens is the image of the tree registers on the retina, and then it goes through the eye into the brain, where it creates an image in the brain, and the tree is not, the observer is something completely extraneous to that which is observed. But with regard to knowledge, we say differently. We say that over here, when the mind perceives something, even though we use the word perceives, it's just a borrowed term. It's not the real proper term to use, but we only can use terms that we have from the physical world as examples. And in the world of the soul, we really get lost. We don't have any terms. All the terms are borrowed from analogies from the external world. So we use the word perceive. We say the mind perceives something, as if, like the eye perceives something. But it's not quite the same phenomenon. Now, what we mean by that is that when the eye sees something, the perceived object is extraneous to it. When the mind perceives an idea, that is not something. That idea, that piece of knowledge that the mind attains, is not an extraneous thing. It's not extraneous baggage. In other words, you do not have a person and his knowledge. You see, in this society, you do. Because in this society, the knowledge is not the essence of the person. So if a person wants to become a physician, they want to become a physician because they want to be able to earn money, they want to have certain prestige or whatever. So the knowledge of medicine is something other than the person, because the person is looking for a personal life, and this is a means to attain it. So all this knowledge, really, is extraneous to the person. But true knowledge of the good, which moves the soul, can never be extraneous to the soul. That is the soul. In other words, when the soul attains knowledge, so this knowledge molds the soul. The individual acts differently, functions in a different way. So the individual, in fact, is different. Therefore, this piece of knowledge cannot be viewed as something extraneous to the individual, but rather that is the individual. Since we're saying, and this ties in very clearly with the afterlife, because the afterlife is where the soul itself retains its existence, because the soul perceives the world of the eternal, and that part of the soul which perceives that the world of the eternal is itself eternal. Now, those ideas that move the soul, which is the prime mover of man, those ideas are in fact what the soul is. In other words, if you have an individual that gains knowledge and their whole life has changed, now they function differently than they did a year ago. So they are not the same person anymore. The knowledge is not extraneous. That is them. So you see that knowledge, what knowledge does is, knowledge simply permits the soul to fulfill its potential. So a soul is really something which exists in potentia, but the knowledge actualizes the soul. Now the soul becomes real and becomes active, becomes realized. So therefore the knowledge in this case is in fact a part of the soul. So the perceiver, which is the soul, and the perceived, which is the knowledge, are one. They become they're one entity. You cannot separate them. Knowledge is an intrinsic part of the person. The sum total of the person is what their knowledge is. Therefore, the knowledge is never an extraneous element. This is an important concept because, first of all, it shows us that the soul functions in a different way than the physical world. Okay, and it also shows us why the person's knowledge is so important in terms of an afterlife, because the knowledge actually shapes the soul, makes the soul into what it is, and only a certain kind of soul can continue to exist in the afterlife, that soul which partakes of the eternal. So the knowledge, like we may view it, I mean, again, using a physical example, as something which shapes and molds the soul. So when the soul continues to exist, it is the soul that continues to exist, not the soul and its knowledge. It is one thing. That one thing has come into existence through the effects that have taken place from the process of knowledge which the soul has engaged in. Okay. This is not, by the way, in contradiction to what we've said before about the fact that it's the attitude of the soul, because again, it's not the purely the knowledge. It is really the attitude which shapes the soul. The attitude is the soul. The soul has a certain attitude towards the knowledge, which comes into existence from two variables: the knowledge itself, and also the way the soul relates to that knowledge. Okay, it's getting a little complex, but okay. Now, there is something else I'd like to mention here, and that is that it's an important concept, one that...
Rabbi?
Yes?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Why, then, how do we explain the fact that if this is based on the knowledge and the soul reacts to the knowledge, does that mean that... Again, this is back to what you were talking about, deeds aspect. Those that have the greater desire for Torah, do they have a greater soul? Those that do not have a desire for Torah, do they have a lesser soul? Or
Okay, that's a good question. Let me try to answer that question. It's a good practical question to which we could use to apply what we've said until now. The question is, does a person who has a greater desire for Torah have a greater soul? Okay? Now, the answer to that question is, we'd have to answer that question. We couldn't answer that question in a simple yes or no. We'd have to break it down. In other words, when you say a greater soul, do you mean a greater soul right now, actualized in terms of actualization, or do you mean a greater soul in potential, potentially greater soul? If you mean an actually greater soul, there's no question that the person who has a greater desire for knowledge has a greater soul. It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that the other person cannot have, in potential, a greater soul. They may have a greater potential for appreciating Torah, but they've never really brought it out. It hasn't been actualized. Now, if that second person with the less of a desire comes across certain situations and exercises free will, they, in fact, may have a far greater soul than the other individual. Okay? So it always depends. When you ask who has a greater soul, the question is, do you mean potentially greater or actually greater? So if you're speaking in actuality, the answer is very simple. Yes, the one who has the greater desire certainly has a greater soul, because he has actualized a certain attitude of the soul, whereas the other person hasn't. But if you're speaking in potentia, it might not necessarily be so, and it can often be just the reverse, that the person simply was unable to exercise free will and up to that point, and that's why their appreciation of Torah is not so great, but they may have a great potential for the appreciation of Torah. Okay. Now, the thing about the afterlife, this idea of the afterlife, also carries us into another area of great importance. It's an area which, again, our modern society is very concerned about, but as our society usually does, it looks into it in a very shallow way. And that is the question of of suffering that we see in this world. Okay. Now, in other words, there are a lot of people that say that the concentration camps, the unfortunate situation of concentration camps, affected people in two different ways. Some people became religious. Many became non-religious because of that. Because they said, well, how can this happen? How can God allow this? So, of course, many books are written to try to give various explanations. But we're not going to go into any explanations as to how God runs the world. But what we're going to show is that this question can be converted into a different kind of question. There are two different types of questions that we have in life. One question is theoretical. In other words, a person has intellectual curiosity, wants to understand something. That's one type of question. There's another kind of question, which is a practical question. I have to know what to do. Should I take this job or not? So I have to have certain information. If I ask questions about the job, this is not theoretical, this is practical. And if the answers are in line with my decision, then with what I'm looking for, then fine, I'll decide that I will take the job. So that's a practical question. Now, once a person understands that the good for man is the Torah, what the Torah prescribes, in other words, that when man keeps the commandments and studies Torah, he is not doing God a favor. The Creator isn't lacking in any way. He doesn't need people to do things for him. But on the contrary, God gave us the opportunity to have a Torah and wisdom and knowledge so that we can live our life to the best of its ability, of our ability. Now, once a person understands that and gets rid of the idea of compensation, which we mentioned before, then a person will realize that when he engages in the study of Torah and the life of Torah and keeping God's commandments and God's way of life, that he is doing himself the greatest benefit. He has the greatest possible life. Now, if a person has that knowledge, then a person could never say, well, look, I don't think this is fair, so therefore I'm not going to do what the Torah says. That would be like a person saying, well, because there were tragedies in the concentration camp, I'm not going to eat any breakfast, and I'm going to stop eating. I mean, what does one thing have to do with the other? A person must always do what is good for them at the time. So when a person makes a decision as to what to do has to be based on what is most beneficial. And if a person recognizes that the life of Torah is the most beneficial life, so then, regardless of the fact, even if they would consider something as being against their judgment, how would that stop them from keeping the Torah? It would be silly. Because what are you going to do? Because you're going to hurt yourself more? Does that make any sense? You see? But obviously, the reason any person that turns away from Torah because they say God did this or God did that, it's obvious that they're operating under the compensation principle, which is that I'm going to do all this hard thing so God should compensate me. Then the question is, one second, how did this happen? Oh, maybe God doesn't compensate people for what they do. You see? So the entire question of God's fairness is really a question which is based on the principle of compensation and not the principle which the Torah espouses, that God gave us the good in the Torah, and it really is good. It's not that he's giving us this to do, which is hard, and he's going to pay us back sometime later. That's not the concept in the Torah. So if a person recognizes that, they will always do the good, because they have to. You have no choice, you see. And that's really the story of Rabbi Akiva, who went out to study Torah, even though the Romans threatened him with death, because he said, without Torah, there's no life. This is simply what must be done. So once a person recognizes Torah in that way, the question of God's justice. Hello? Yes? Hello?
We're still here.
Okay. I have some interference here.
Okay.
Okay. Then the question of God's justice has no practical relevance whatsoever. It's like the Torah is the only way for a person to live, because that is really the good. And that's all. You have to live that way. Unless you're a fool, you want to harm yourself. But any intelligent person will always live according to the Torah. Now, what about God's justice? That becomes an academic question. It's a question which a person may be curious about. Moses was very curious about it, too. It's a question that the whole book of Job is about. It's a question which is something a person must always pursue knowledge. And a person must pursue, we are permitted to pursue knowledge on all fronts and try as best as we can to understand whatever we can through the abilities that we have, but it is not a practical question. And, of course, an intelligent person will not jump to that question first, because there's a hierarchy in learning, and the first thing is to learn the most basic things of Torah. Before a person can enter into understanding how God does things, he has to first try to partake of the knowledge that God made available to him on a basic level and understand that. But it is a legitimate area of inquiry, but it's one which a person should not engage in unless they're really on a very high level. For Moses, this was the level he was on. He wanted to understand God. Moses didn't engage in the question, because it was a question of whether he's going to keep Torah or not. You see, that's an infantile mind. But on a higher level, Moses had a curiosity about God's justice, and that's why he was pursuing it out of a quest for knowledge, not out of a complaint or an ultimatum that if this is not this way, I'm not going to do the Torah. That's an infantile notion. That's based on the notion of compensation. So the concept of the afterlife is an extremely important one, because it really cuts right through that question that affects many, many people's lives. I mean, many people feel, well, if this is the way things are, then I'm not going to keep the Torah. That is simply silly, because if the Torah is the good, so then you have to. You have no choice. That's only if you think the Torah is compensation. Okay. Are there any questions?
No, I don't see any hands going up.
All right. Then maybe what I'll do is conclude. I will conclude with something that a piece of the Talmud which caught my eye because of a book that David sent to me, a current book on the afterlife, and I was leafing through it and I noticed something, and I'm using this as an example just to show you that the many books that we have today are really not written by scholars, and they're unreliable and untrustworthy. And what they do is, people like, if you have a subject like the afterlife, what they'll do is, well, now all we have to do is just go through the Talmud and find every place that the Talmud mentions afterlife, and then we have a compendium of the Talmudic idea of afterlife. Well, it just doesn't work that simply. And here is a good example. It's an example that I'm choosing because I'd like to take the opportunity also to show you how to unravel properly something that the Talmud explains. This was quoted in this book, and it was stated that there are many things that can cause a person to go to Gehenna, which is hell, and the person said, well, the rabbis of the Talmud thought that one of the things that can take a person and get a person into hell is a statement found in the tractate of Bava Metzia, 59a. And the statement runs as follows. Whoever goes after the advice of his wife falls into hell, into Gehenna. Okay? Now, this person thought that the rabbis of Talmud considered that very simply, very simple statement, that they felt that, especially in Asai, well, there you see, the Talmud thinks that the man is superior and the wife is inferior, so listen to advice, you go to hell. Okay, but it's not that simple. You see, you have to read the rest of the Talmudic statement. The rest of the Talmudic statement is a quote from Kings 1:21. Because over there it speaks about Ahab, and it mentions that Ahab was invited by his wife. In other words, she instigated him. So the prophet really says that Ahab, the things that Ahab did, many of the things he did, were not due, not things that he would have done on his own, but it was because of his relationship with his wife that she incited him to do it. Okay? Now, now I'm going to read you the rest of the Talmud, so you see it's very interesting. The rest of the Talmud's like this. So, the one who was the author of that statement was Rav, by the way, one of the greatest scholars of the Talmud, was a student of Rabbi Judah the Prince, and sat on his court, and when he made that statement, so Rav Papa, another scholar, he said to Abaye, he said, he asked him a question, he said, how could that be true? He says, but people say, that if your wife is, it's a parable, if your wife is small, is short, bend down and listen to her, okay? Meaning, it's just a parable, which means to say that you should always, obviously should always listen to your wife. So then the Talmud says, it's not, there's no difficulty. Why? Because it depends what the subject matter is. If the subject matter is Torah, so then Rav is right. Don't listen to your wife. If the subject matter is worldly things, we're discussing worldly things, then yes, then listen to her. Now the Gemara has another opinion. Another opinion is like this, that the another opinion is there's another opinion, and that is, no, it depends. If it's worldly things, even worldly things, don't listen to your wife. However, if it's things of the household, like what type of furniture to have, or things like that, then you can listen to your wife. Okay. Now, let's just analyze this piece of Talmud for a moment, okay? We know very well that the people of the Talmud knew the Bible very well, and they were aware of the fact that God told Abraham that he should listen very carefully to the words of his wife, Sarah. As a matter of fact, she was a greater prophet, the rabbis say, than Abraham was, Abraham was instructed by God to listen to her. So the rabbis themselves made that statement, by the way, she was a great prophet. So obviously the rabbis had a very high esteem for the role of a woman. Moreover, Rabbi Meir, who was one of the greatest of scholars, I'm sure you've heard his name, the Talmud tells a famous story how he was praying. He had neighbors that were really bothering him and tormenting him, and when he was praying that they should be removed, they should be destroyed. So his wife said, "No, don't pray that way. You should pray that they should change, that they should see the truth." And he listened to her. So he changed his prayer because of her. So you see, the rabbis of Talmud listened very carefully to their wife. What exactly does the rabbis of Talmud explain over here? And this is what I'm going to give you the explanation. The explanation is that the Talmud recognizes that there are two kinds of conversations that go on between people. One conversation is a rational conversation, okay, so people discuss something, what to do. But then there's a conversation that takes place between a man and a wife. That's a different kind of a conversation. That's a conversation which is based on the relationship, a romantic relationship that exists between man and a wife. And it's something wherein a person, when one party gives in to the other, they do so because of the relationship. It's not because of the ideas, but the relationship demands that if you respect another person and that people are in love with each other, so in that relationship, they listen to the other one and they give in to the other one. That's a different kind of a conversation. Now, what the Talmud is explaining is as follows. The Talmud is saying that kind, and it doesn't mean for the wife, it works both ways. Because you see, an interesting thing is that first the Talmud quotes a verse from the Kings, and then the Talmud says, but people say the other way. So why does the Talmud say, well, who cares what people say if God says this? What is the Talmud concerned about? Obviously, the Talmud is not speaking, the Talmud is speaking a totally different frame of reference. What the Talmud is saying is, no, what people are saying are true, because the Talmud maintains that people do have wisdom in general. That's why such things are aphorisms. The Talmud does respect the wise things that people say. And the Talmud is saying that it depends. it's a kind of conversation, you see, that has to do with the relationship, so that kind of conversation is not appropriate, the Talmud says, in the case of Torah. Because in the case of Torah, you want to know what God wants you to do. And there, the conversation must be strictly logical. You cannot give in to the other person, the other party, to show your love and your affection in such a case, because then what you're doing is you're destroying the truth of Torah. Now, one opinion said, but when that's good when it comes to Torah, but when it comes to everything else, then it's proper for a person, one party, if it's a man or a woman, the Talmud is in the case of a man, but it's true both ways, it's proper for one person to have such a conversation and to give in to the other party. That was one opinion. The only time you can't do that is when you're dealing with Torah. The other opinion was no. Even in worldly things, there is no place for such a conversation. In worldly matters also, you should stick to reason and to logic, and this shouldn't be it shouldn't be a conversation that involves the relationship, the romantic relationship between the couple. Because in many worldly things, if you make a mistake, you could suffer. The person makes a mistake, for instance, worldly things, business, and if you do things in order to please your spouse in business, you may suffer great losses. So, of course, an intelligent person will differentiate and say, well, in that case I wouldn't, but in this case I would. So one opinion of Talmud is, oh, it's okay if you differentiate. Another opinion is, no, when it comes to worldly things, that's not the area for a romantic kind of conversation. Romantic conversation should be relegated to the area of the home, things that are done together in a way where one expresses affection towards the other person. That's precisely what the Talmud is saying. The Talmud is really, when the Talmud says that the person falls into a Gehenna, which means that they lose a part of the afterlife, of course, what the Talmud means to say is that the person is going to destroy themselves if they allow a romantic element to override a rational element when they're having a conversation and they're making a decision and discussing it with their spouse. That's really what the Talmud is saying. The Talmud is not giving a simple statement there, but the only way you can appreciate what the Talmud is saying is by studying it properly and reading the full part of the Talmud and applying one's intellect and understanding to it. Okay, I think we'll stop here.
Okay.